Okay, good morning, everyone. Everyone doing all right? Yeah? Okay, excellent. That means we can carry on, which is good. Or maybe it's not, I'm not sure. Is carrying on, is it good or bad? I don't know. The Buddha says we should stop, right? So I'm not sure if carrying on is, depends. I guess it depends on what we mean by carrying on. Okay, have a look at this later on. So we are going to continue with this sutta called on the overcoming of resentment, and we had a look at the three first cases where the person still has some good qualities left, and we focus on the good qualities to give rise to a sense of metta or friendliness or good perception of that person. But now we come to the person who has no good qualities, and then the question is, what do we do then? And this was a question we had just yesterday, so now we get the answer to that question here. Okay, so this is how it goes. So how should you get rid of resentment for a person whose behavior by body and speech is impure and who doesn't get an openness and clarity of the heart from time to time? Suppose a person was traveling along a road and they were sick, suffering, and gravely ill. And it was a long way to a village, whether ahead or behind. And they didn't have any suitable food or medicine or a competent carer or someone to bring them within a village. Then another person traveling along the road sees them and thinks of them with nothing but compassion, kindness, and sympathy. Oh, may this person get suitable food or medicine or a competent carer or someone to bring them within a village. Why is that? So that they don't come to ruin right here. In the same way, at that time, you should ignore that person's impure behavior by way of body and speech, and the fact that they don't get an openness and clarity of the heart from time to time, and think of them with nothing but compassion, kindness, and sympathy. Oh, may this person give up bad conduct by body, speech, and mind, and develop good conduct by body, speech, and mind. Why is that? So that when their body breaks up after death, they're not reborn in a place of loss, a bad place, the underworld, in hell. That is how to get rid of resentment for that person. So here we have a person who you cannot see any good qualities in. Yeah, all you see is bad qualities. And I think one of the first things to realize about this is that when we talk about someone not having any good qualities, only having bad qualities, this is our perception of that person, right? It is not, we don't actually know the qualities of another person, but what we see is kind of bad qualities. And once you realize that it is your perception of that person, it is not the reality that you are seeing, you actually don't... You give them the opportunity to change, right? You realize that down the track they may actually change, they may become a better person. And so you don't judge them once and for all and says this is a bad person. You realize that this is my perception at this particular time. And that is another way of having compassion for people and being generous and being... judging too harshly, but allowing that change to happen in other people, which is something we should always do, because then, again, this is this idea that if you judge people very harshly, they tend to be trapped by that judgment. But if you are open and you allow them to change, it's actually an act of generosity and kindness for others. So remember that when we look at people, there's always our own perception. It is not reality that we are seeing. There is no reality. And when you do that, you allow people to change, you allow them to show their better side to you, and you say, wow, actually, they have good qualities after all. What a wonderful thing that is. I think that is one of the kind of things that where we often go wrong in our world. We judge people too harshly, and we put them in a box, and once they are in that box, we kind of lock it off, and then there is no room for that person to change later on. And that is I think it's a kind of harshness that we should really not try to avoid, especially on the Buddhist path. You don't see any good qualities, and it's the beautiful simile here, like the sick person traveling along the road, there's no village, no village either ahead or behind. In other words, there's no place to find safety, right, from that sickness. There's no place to find support, a nurse or a doctor, anything like that. And there's no suitable food or medicine. And this is probably a bit like the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the food and the medicine for a person who does bad things. No competent carer, and probably that's the Buddha, the competent carer, someone to bring them within the village. And the village here, not sure what that is, maybe that's the kind of the community of Buddhists or something, or someone who is friendly, someone who can give them good advice, a wise person, regardless of who it is perhaps. And then, of course, when you see someone like that, if you see someone in really difficult situation, in big trouble, and they're heading towards their own demise, they're heading towards even more illness or whatever, how do you feel about that? Well, you tend to feel compassionate for them, right? You're seeing this person staggering along the road, and you know that they're going maybe towards their own end or whatever. You feel a sense of compassion. You want to do something. You want to help them. You feel kindness and sympathy and compassion. That is kind of a beautiful way of thinking about people who have bad qualities. Instead of actually looking at them, being afraid of them, seeing how they may hurt you or they may hurt others, remembering they have no idea what they're doing. They are sick. They are mentally slightly deranged. The Buddha says in the suttas that anger is a kind of madness. Because when you're angry, you have no idea what's going on. Your world is distorted. You have no idea what's happening. But very often, we're not just mad when we are angry, but we are slightly mad all the time, because we have all these delusions. We live in a world that is not clear. We have the sense of self, which the Buddha says actually doesn't correspond to any reality. So we're always deluded. We're always slightly distorted in our outlook. And sometimes that distortion goes a long, long way. And then we do crazy things. We do things that are bad by body, speech, and mind. We think that we're doing things that lead to our own happiness. We think we're doing things that lead to the happiness of others. But actually what we're doing is incredibly destructive and bad. But we have no idea what's going on. We're walking in darkness, walking in delusion. And because of that, we're hitting ourselves, stubbing our toes, hitting our head against the rafters in the ceiling, because we don't know what's going on. And this is such a way of looking at people, which is really so different from how people in the world look at people. This idea of seeing that people don't really, they probably don't want to be bad. Does anyone want to be bad in this world? Do we really want to be bad, or do we, just coming from my own perspective and what I see in other people, I think most people actually want to be kinder. And the reason is because we somehow know that deep down we know that kindness is somehow equated with good results, feeling good about yourself, etc. I think we kind of know that almost instinctively. And so when we then do things that are unkind, it's just because of delusion. It's because of some layer on the outside that blinds us to what actually is an instinctual truth for many of us. We think we're doing the right thing and we're going wrong. So by thinking in this way, you start to feel compassion, even for the people who are the most, we might call them evil or whatever in this world. Actually, we realize they're not really evil. They're just blind. They don't know what they're doing here. And if you can take the things like the war in Ukraine as an example. When you see these kind of soldiers from Russia invading Ukraine, you might get angry with them. But actually, do these soldiers, do they know what they're doing? Often they're just young men, maybe in their late teens or early 20s. They have very little life experience. They don't really know what's going on. And they're being kind of manipulated by these large forces in society that kind of push them in that certain direction, whatever it might be. Because of that, you kind of, even in that situation, even those soldiers, even though they are perpetrators of crimes that are really bad sometimes, still you can understand that actually they are also trapped in a very profound way. Yeah, and then you can kind of take that further. You can maybe look at, maybe what about the commanders of the army, the generals? And you start to understand these too are trapped in a certain way. What about the very top of the hierarchy? What about someone like Vladimir Putin? Many people probably think he is a bad person. But he too is trapped in the system, trapped in a larger thing, deluded about reality. And even though he does terrible crimes, in a sense he doesn't really understand what is going on. Otherwise, he would never do it. We all think that we're doing the right thing, even when we're doing the wrong thing. And so in this way, we kind of turn the table in a beautiful way. Because very often, when we do get upset with the people around us, it is because of self-concern. And it's okay to have self-concern. There is not much choice about it. We are, again, as I said before, we are the center of our own world. And so, of course, we have self-concern. But also the feeling of being too self-concerned, of being too focused on me all the time, it leads to this small little world inside of us. It leads to a world where the world outside seems scary and dangerous, because too much focus on me leads to the sense of the barrier or a sense of boundary, a sense of otherness with the world outside. And you see this with people in the world that kind of lock themselves up in these private estates or whatever, with walls around them and kind of guards or whatever. You see this in places like where there's a lot of violence in society, like South Africa, for example. Of course, that kind of creates this me over here, the dangerous world outside. And the more we focus on me in this way, the more alienated the world outside becomes. And the whole world becomes like a scary and dangerous place, the more we focus on ourselves. So this idea of having compassion, even for the perpetrators of crimes, is actually understanding the broader picture of what is going on. And once you understand that broader picture, you start looking at even the people who treat you badly, you start looking at them in a different way. They probably don't want to treat you badly. They probably want to be your friend. They just don't understand how to do it in the right way. And once you see that, and you see that they are doing things that lead to their own suffering, to the suffering of others, even though they want to create happiness in the world, you start to have compassion for them, because they are blind, they are deluded, they are in darkness, they have no idea what's going on. It's kind of you start to understand kind of the tragedy of the world. Yeah? It's like people who are deluded affecting other people who are deluded. We hurt each other without really understanding what we're doing. And this is kind of almost like the tragedy of the world. Don't focus too much on that, because it might get you depressed if you think too much about those things. Also see the goodness in the world, of course. But if you remember this, then you can have compassion. And this is why compassion is secondary to metta. Too much focus on that kind of compassion, maybe it can have potentially detrimental effect as well. So this is how you turn the table. And it's kind of very strange when you do that. Because you may go from a position where you are very self-concerned, very thinking about yourself, and you withdraw into your own little small little world. And suddenly you understand, no, compassion is the right thing. You turn the table. And the moment you do that, your mind kind of expands. Instead of being contracted within your own little self, it goes out into the whole world. And it's this change in a fingersnap, going from this tiny little mind to the large mind, which is broad and encompassing of all the beings around you. It's such a powerful moment when you see that happens. And you kind of include everyone in the world within your kindness and your compassion and your understanding. So this is the ideal way of dealing with people who are difficult. And we all have our difficult people in our life. Is there anyone here who has never met a difficult person? It's just impossible, right? There's no such thing as a life without difficult people. This is just life for you. And so this sort of attitude is very useful for every one of us. Perhaps you think that in monastic life you never meet difficult people, but actually that's not true. Huh? Yeah, even monastic life you meet difficult people. Huh? Even though I think monastic life is a wonderful thing, it is still part of humanity. Yeah, you haven't kind of extracted yourself from humanity yet at least. It's still, still there, so you have to deal with people. Monastic life is often like a microcosm of the broader society. All kinds of people become monks. And anyway, you meet many people who are not monks as well, of course. So this is how to reflect in this case. Remember that the people who are doing bad things, they are like sick people. And then you want to be compassionate towards them instead. And you can see here, someone asked yesterday about the difference between empathy and compassion. Compassion is this wanting, desire to help. Yeah, you see someone dire in a difficult situation. So how do you help someone who is bad in this way? Well, you have to be very careful, because sometimes people are not they don't want to listen to you very often, right? Maybe you want to help them, but maybe they don't want your help. So what can you do sometimes? Sometimes all you can do is just be compassionate from a distance. At other times, if you have the opportunity and an opening, something opens up, then you can take the opportunity to say something. Maybe they are reachable, maybe not. Sometimes people will be reachable. So compassion, how you use your compassion will depend on the situation. And this is where wisdom comes in. Tells you, can I reach this person or can I not? Yeah, this is really how this, what this is about. But still, the idea of being able to do something for others, that takes away some of that despair and some of the negative aspect of pure empathy, where you may lose your energy and lose your ability to be effective in the world. So this is one way of thinking about this. One of the kind of important points here that underlies this whole idea of compassion and seeing people is to remember that from a Buddhist point of view, we are not so much autonomous agents in the world. In the Western world, from the kind of Western ideas, the Christian kind of worldview that most people who have been brought up in the West are brought up with. I was never a Christian, but you're still brought up in that culture, right? So it kind of is part of the worldview that you kind of take on board, whether you want to or not. And in that culture, the idea of being autonomous, being the agent of your own happiness, of having a sense of free will, and you kind of, because free will is fundamental to the idea of Christianity, right? This idea of free will, this whole thing is so ingrained in us that we need to kind of look at things in a new way. And what the Buddha says, free will, that whole question of free will is almost like a red herring in Buddhism, because the point is that we are conditioned in Buddhism. And sometimes when you start to look at yourself and look at your own life and you look back at who you were 10 years ago, look at who you were before, you can start to see how trapped you have been in the past, how you couldn't really do anything different. When I look back on my own life, there are things that I am not proud of. I think back, I wish I hadn't done those things. I don't have anything massive things I regret, because I haven't been any kind of super-duper evil person in my life. But everyone has done things they're not proud of, right? And I would rather not have to tell you what those things are. But when I look back, I ask myself, could I have done differently? And when I look at all the circumstances, all the kind of blocks that kind of came together, I think, no, I probably couldn't do anything differently. There were just all these things coming together at that time. And the moment you see that actually you were trapped by those habits, trapped by the personality, trapped by the environment, trapped by the conditioning of the people around you, at that moment, you can forgive yourself. That's a beautiful moment. You say, okay, it wasn't a good idea. I'll try not to do it again in the future. But at that time, I didn't have much choice. And then you can forgive the things, yeah? You can forgive the time when you feel that maybe you didn't look after your children properly. Someone mentioned this to me earlier on. And you realize, actually, no, the conditions were such. I did what I had to do at that time. Maybe I would choose differently now. But at that time, that was the only thing I could do. And then you don't have any guilt about it. You don't have any issues with it. You can let go and you can carry on. This is how how forgiveness comes about, because forgiveness can be very hard, right? It's difficult. How can we forgive? And if you start to see other people, other beings as trapped in traits, trapped in their conditioning, trapped in their background, trapped in by their upbringing, trapped by their past lives, right? We come into this world with a certain personality, with certain personal characteristics that come with us. And so we are bound by those things. And if I ask you to step outside of your personality, you're going to think I'm crazy, right? Because that's impossible, because that is the personality, that's who we are. You cannot step outside of your personality. So your personality, in many ways, is a trap. We feel proud. Yeah, I've built up this personality. I've educated myself, done all of these kind of things. I've built up kind of good qualities in my heart. And that's good. So to the extent that you are moving towards freedom, it's a positive thing. But all the things that are hindering us from practicing the spiritual path, those are the aspects of your personality that are a trap, that are hindering you, blocking you from moving forward. So personality is very often a trap. Yeah, so remember that. And when you do remember that, then forgiveness becomes possible. People are like more like robots than things of free will. People are running on programs, and these programs were written sometime deep in the past that we can no longer access. And now you're just following along the program, saying yes, sir, yes, ma'am, to that program, moving on, not really understanding what you're doing. So this is kind of the Buddhist outlook, yeah? And this is what you find in certain suttas. You find this in the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the Sutta on the characteristics of non-self. And one of the things the Buddha says in there is that your choices, your will, cannot really be chosen. You cannot choose your choices. Yeah, you make those choices, they happen according to conditions. It is not, you know, you cannot. They cannot be otherwise. And so this kind of makes it fairly clear that free will is really a red herring, according to the Buddhist teachings. Anyway, it's the idea of free will is problematic because, first of all, we have to define it in the right way. I'm not saying, if we say there's no free will, people think, it means that I have no agency. Of course you have agency. But where does the agency come from? Is the agency itself, it's conditioned? That's really the point. It doesn't mean that what you do doesn't matter. What you do matters enormously. Your intentions are very important. But where do the intentions come from? That is really the question here. And if those intentions are predetermined or conditioned to a very large extent, that is what we mean by this being trapped in a certain way. So these are just some ideas about how to think about other people, right? Understand that they are actually trapped, they are conditioned, their habits are very powerful and very, very strong, and it's actually very difficult for them to do otherwise than what they are doing. And then compassion, kindness, forgiveness becomes possible. And please forgive yourself. Don't carry around guilt and all of these silly things that are really useless in this world. Certainly learn from your mistakes. Learning is incredibly important. Don't make those mistakes again if you can avoid it. Sometimes we make the mistakes again. Forgive yourself again. How often should you forgive? You know that saying? That's another one of these Ajahn Brahm catchphrases. How often should you forgive? Always one more time. Beautiful, right? It's kind of very to the point. This is the idea here with a person with bad qualities. Let's take a 5-minute meditation break and we can have a few questions and discussion. Okay. So, so would anyone like to say anything about this? Yes, please, at the back here. Yeah.
And the idea of just walking by and saying, you know, and think, I hope you get help.
Yeah.
But yeah. I know they're trying to, you know, fixing mentality can be a trap.
I think the point is more like you're seeing someone from a distance. I think that's the point. You're seeing something, you can't really, you're too far away. Maybe you're standing on a mountaintop, you're seeing someone way, way, away, and you're saying, wow, that's, or seeing someone on TV, right? You can't really do anything at that time. I think that's the point. I think that if you were there, you would do something. Yeah, yeah. I think that's kind of the issue here. Yeah. Please.
I live close to a peace pagoda here, which is a Nichiren sect, but the monks and nuns there, anybody who comes up there, they see them, they'll do this deep bow.
Okay.
And when the nun did that to me, it just blew my mind. Because it really upped my sense of myself.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think about that a lot in terms of just that inner attitude when you see people.
Yeah.
You can kind of bow to that.
Okay,
uplift
yeah.
Lift them, kind of. I don't know. It really made an impression on me that they would bow to anyone.
Anyone, right. Yeah.
And deep respect, you know, just for being
just for being a human on the planet, yeah. It's a respectful, it's kind of an act of respect probably, you know, and showing your respect in a way. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And
I would do that to someone yeah. if I saw them, but
yeah.
just that attitude
yeah.
really uplifted me, and sometimes
yeah.
I think about
right.
that when I'm with someone.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things we can do to be kind to each other and show each other respect
yeah.
and kindness, you know, and sometimes the things we can do is to kind of just remind each other of our good qualities, you know, and say, I appreciate this in you and these things. And this is so important. I, you know, one of the things that I did when my father was on his kind of dying of, you know, he had cancer and he was obviously coming towards his end. And I had realized for a while that when I was young, I was far too critical of my parents. Yeah, this is what everyone is when you're young. You're kind of critical of your parents. It's kind of par for the course almost. And I felt that I should do something about that. So I wrote to my father and I said, actually, you've been a wonderful father. And I kind of went on for quite a long time about all the kind of qualities. Because when you're going to praise someone, you have to go into the details. Otherwise, it sounds superficial. You really have to kind of say exactly what it is about. And that was very powerful. You know, especially when it's someone very close to you, like your father, it has a very powerful impact. I could feel that he was touched by that later on. And you know, this is the thing we should do more often with each other in society as well, with our friends, with our family members, with whoever, and kind of give them some kind of uplift. Mutual respect is very important. This is why in Thailand, this is what lay people do to each other, yeah, it's kind of mutual respect. You travel to India, everyone says namaste, namaste, right? It's kind of, and namaste. If you notice yesterday, we were doing the chanting to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, it's like Sanghang Namasami. Namasami is the same word as namaste in India. Same word. It means like honor or respect or something like that. So, yes, and sometimes small little things in life, we can show each other kindness and respect, we can do things, you know. Traditionally in Buddhism, it is also, the Anjali gesture is between equals, but it's also kind of, also used hierarchically as well. So usually lay people will do Anjali to a monk, and a monk would not normally do Anjali to a lay person. If I did that in Asia, to lay person, they would feel very uncomfortable. They think, oh, what's going on here? Something, what are they trying to get out of me or something? I don't know. I know what you mean, and we treat each other in a good way, yeah. So that's good, huh? One thing I should maybe say about this whole thing of, you know, having compassion for others is that sometimes people think, well, if I look at people and I think of them as deluded or being dark, it means that I get a big ego, I look down upon them because it means that I think I'm better, yeah. But that would be the wrong way of doing it, yeah, for obvious reasons. So the idea here is to remember that we all have this potential for being deluded. And sometimes we are deluded, sometimes we are less deluded, but we all make these kind of mistakes. And because of that, there's no real basis for putting yourself higher up just because you see someone else who is deluded. Okay, you have compassion for them. It doesn't mean you look down upon them. It just means that, well, now they are worthy of compassion because now they are in a problematic situation. This is important, otherwise we just create another problem. Yeah, we create ego. Okay, before we were angry, now we have a big ego instead. It doesn't really help very much. So we want to get all of these defilements to go down. This comes from this teaching of the Buddha of not being conceited. Yeah, it talks about the three kinds of conceit: the superiority conceit, the inferiority conceit, and the equality conceit. I love this idea of the equality conceit. This is kind of the Western society conceit, right? I'm the same. Yeah, I'm equal, whatever. Yeah. But once there is equality, there's also superiority and inferiority. These things come together. Yeah. You can't have one without the other. Yeah. But the Buddhist idea is you can't really judge. There is no judgment. There is nothing. If there was a self and there was some inherent characteristics to you, who you actually are as a person, well, those inherent characteristics would enable judgment, because then you can compare inherent characteristic with inherent characteristic. But when our characteristics are always fluctuating, I mean, what comparison can be made? One day, maybe you have better qualities than me, another day I have better qualities than you. Yeah, so what comparison can you make? It's impossible. Comes from this idea of non-self again. So don't judge in this way either. Yes?
I was wondering about, like, from a Buddhist perspective, the relationship between, like, brain physiology and, like, karma, and whether to think about it too as, like, someone might be trapped in, like, a psychopathic brain or something.
Right, exactly. That's a good point, isn't it? You actually have a certain chemistry or whatever that kind of traps you in a certain way. So I think that's probably part of what is happening. You know, you get reborn into this world, and maybe your karma creates a brain for you that is bad, and maybe that karma actually creates that chemistry, which then is destructive. And then it's actually quite hard to get out, because the chemistry then tends to condition you, and then you have to work really hard. But then you have the plasticity of the brain, right? So then you can actually emerge through that plasticity. And that's kind of interesting, this idea that the brain is plastic is something that has kind of emerged only during the last 20, 30 years in neuroscience. Before that, they thought what you're given is fixed, right? And this shows you how careful you have to be with science sometimes, because this is what I mean by the distinction between the facts of science and the opinions of scientists, that there is a big difference there. So the idea that the brain was non-plastic obviously was just an opinion of scientists. It wasn't a fact of science. And so very often we buy into these opinions, and that kind of traps us in a certain way. But I agree with that. That's a good point. Just shows how that entrapment is not just habits of the mind, but also kind of physically actually you're trapped by things. Yeah. So, yeah. Yes, please. Okay, Sadhu, thank you for those kind comments. I'm very, very glad to hear that. Great, excellent. Okay, shall we carry on? Yeah, let us carry on. All right, so now we come to the very last person in the sutta. This is the person who is the good person. This is like the saint we come to now. And it goes as follows. How should you get rid of resentment for a person whose behavior by way of body and speech is pure, and who gets an openness and clarity of the heart from time to time? Suppose there was a lotus pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean with smooth banks, delightful and shaded by many trees. Then along comes a person struggling in the oppressive heat, weary, thirsty and parched. They would plunge into the lotus pond to bathe and drink, and after emerging, they would sit or lie down right there in the shade of the trees. It's kind of a nice nice simile. So here you come to the, this is like the saint, yeah, the person who has a good mind, good body, good speech. So this is like coming to a lotus pond. The lotus pond is the person. And of course, the person is full of good qualities, so the water is clear, sweet, cool, clean. And not only is the water cool, but the banks around are even nice. It's like this is the kind of the vibe around the person, the juju. I love that word juju. I just learned it now after coming to the U.S. I learned that in California. They said juju. So fine. I'm going to use this word, I thought. So even the area around is really nice, delightful, lots of kind of trees and everything around there. And then still you're angry, right? You're pressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. And this is kind of one of the weird things in the world, that we get angry with people who are just wonderful sometimes. Yeah, sometimes we are so silly. You know what it's like? Yeah. And if people get angry with the Buddha, you find this in the suttas. People get angry with, sometimes I get angry with Ajahn Brahm. I get upset and I think, what is going on here? It's kind of really silly. This is just the way things are, because it is not the person that makes us angry. It is our perception of the person that makes us angry. So we perceive the person in the wrong way, and that is what happens. But of course, because it is our perceptions, it is very easy to deal with. So you just plunge into those personal qualities, the beautiful, cool water or whatever, and then you just drink it up. And it's very easy to come out of that anger. So it is very important in life that we are very careful with our judgment of people. Yeah, it's very easy to judge people too quickly. The thing about the Buddhist teaching, it can be quite challenging. And sometimes people will tell you something that you don't really want to hear it. So then what you have to be careful, you have to distinguish between your unwillingness to hear because it is just too challenging and the qualities of the person. You shouldn't get angry with the person just because it's challenging what they say. And this is what happens in the sutta sometimes. The Buddha will tell you something very challenging instead of actually looking at that carefully and saying, okay, I can't deal with it now. And that's okay. I mean, sometimes things are too challenging. You can't deal with it. Put it to one side. And then come back to it later on. If the Buddha talks about non-self and you don't really like that idea of non-self, well, come back later on. Maybe later on you will be able to deal with that in a kind of reasonable way. This is kind of the right approach. There is a nice sutta where there's a Brahmin, he's called Akosaka Bharadvaja. Bharadvaja is one of those famous Brahmin names. And Akosaka means the abusive one. So I don't think that was his actual name. That was probably a nickname he got because he was abusive. His mum didn't call him the abusive one. That would be a strange mum if she'd called him that. But that was the nickname he got. So obviously he had a problem with anger, right? Let's face it. So he goes up to the Buddha and he kind of shouts at the Buddha and says the Buddha is bad, and he's kind of taking all the Brahmins and ordaining them. Your Brahmins are becoming monks. The Brahmins should stay as Brahmins. Yeah, or listen, Master Gautama, this is not good. You are bad, or whatever he says. And then the Buddha says to him, he says, I don't accept your anger. This anger belongs to you. And he says, what do you mean the anger belongs to me? And then he gives this nice simile. He says, it's like when you have guests for dinner and everyone eats and then everyone leaves, and whatever food is left over when everyone has left, who does it belong to? Well, it belongs to the host, right? In the same way, your anger belongs to you. I don't take your anger. And this is just such a nice way of thinking about it. Yeah, someone is angry with you. Actually, they are the one who have the problem. Yeah, they are the one who are making bad karma. They are acting out these deep-seated traits and habits that are within them without really being in control. They are the ones who have the problem. And this is like an extension of what we were talking about before, how to have compassion for people. Yeah, it is not your problem if someone treats you badly. It is the other person's problem. They are the one who are stuck in bad qualities and bad things. And if you make it your problem, that is your choice. But don't make it your problem. Because actually, it has nothing to do with you. It has everything to do with the other person. This is, again, this helping you to have compassion for people in this particular way. So but anyway, I'm kind of going back to the previous point now. But the idea here is that there are people in the world with kind of wonderful qualities who really are. You feel they are special when you get into their presence. And that's a wonderful thing. And of course, then you overcome your anger very quickly because you know that actually there's no basis to have anger. And then you kind of lie down in their vicinity, or you hang out in their vicinity, right? You stay with them because actually it just feels nice to be around people like that. Yeah, it's kind of strange how some people's presence just feels nice. You want to be with them. You don't want to go anywhere else. This is good. And that's a... very marvelous when that happens. And then, of course, you end up becoming the disciple, right? That's why you hang out in the shade of those trees and you become the disciple, or the person become the disciple of the Buddha. Yeah? And this then is kind of how these things, how it works itself out. And one of the things that I remember always caught my attention when I was reading the suttas, and that is where it says that even the sight of someone who is fully awakened, even the sight of an arahant is incredibly beneficial in the world. If you see someone who has practiced really well, someone whose mind obviously is peaceful, someone who is full of kindness, and you are in the kind of vicinity of that person, yeah, just that sight, just seeing something which normally cannot be seen in our society will leave a very powerful impact on you. Because now suddenly you know that something alternative is possible, right? If someone is consistently kind, consistently peaceful, not only once, not just you know, during a short period of time, a few days or whatever, but week in, week out, year in, year out, and they have that consistency, and you watch that and you see that that's actually what is going on, it just has a very powerful impact on you, because it is not normally what we see in our society. You see that there is some alternative here. There's not another way of living life. There is another... way of developing ourselves that leads in a very different direction. So just the sight of an arahant, yeah, or even a stream enter, or even someone who gets deep meditation can be very powerful. And then, of course, you listen to them, becomes even more powerful. Then you practice the path, becomes even more powerful. Then you realize it yourself. Then it becomes really, really powerful. Yeah, and this kind of thing kind of carries on like this. So I would recommend you, this can be useful to meet people in the world who have practiced really well like this. Sometimes it can be worthwhile traveling halfway around the world to actually be able to meet people who are special. I mean, it's not as if I'm sure maybe even some of the people who come here may be very powerful. Someone like Venerable Anālaya is quite an impressive monk. He's just down the cutie down there. And I've known him for quite a long time. And no doubt, sometimes you have people who come through who are impressive. So take those opportunities to meet people with special qualities, because it can open your eyes to an alternative reality. But again, be careful, because sometimes it can also be, it may not be as real as you think it is. It is very easy to be deluded by these things. It is easy for someone to keep up appearances for a short period of time. Is how deep does it go, right? That can be very hard to judge. So the Buddha says in the suttas, if you want to judge someone's integrity, if you want to judge their wisdom, first of all, you have to be wise yourself. That is a difficult one, right? How wise am I? Okay, so that's really problematic. Then you have to judge over a long period of time, right? And you have to be very attentive to what is going on. So be careful with these things. Don't jump onto the bandwagon too quickly. Yeah, and just go slowly with these things. So you become like a disciple of the Buddha, yeah, because the Buddha is special. And then it says, in the same way, at that time, you should focus on that person's pure behavior by way of body and speech, and on the fact that they get an openness and clarity of the heart from time to time. That is how to get rid of resentment for that person. Relying on a person who is impressive all around, the mind becomes confident. A mendicant should use these five methods to completely get rid of resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. So, there you are, the sutta on resentment. Are you happy with that sutta? Yeah? There's a lot of good stuff, lots of really good stuff in these teachings of the Buddha. So, all right, so this is the most important kind of defilement to deal with, resentment, ill will, irritation, anger, rage, and etc., etc. And so this is why I consider this sutta very pragmatic, very important, very, very useful for the vast majority of people. So please consider that carefully. Remember that one thing is to listen to the teaching. One thing is to read the Sutta of the Buddha. Another thing is to make it real for yourself. And making it real for yourself means that you have to reflect on these things, not just once, but again and again and again. And as you do that, it starts to become real. You start to see these things in the same way as the Buddha saw it. And this is one of the reasons why when I teach retreats, and I teach many, many retreats every year, various parts of the world, traveling around, I teach this sutta every time, yeah, and I enjoy it every time because it reminds me every time of what is the right attitude to have. So, and when you teach it, you go into more detail than when you just read it for yourself. So please bring this back to mind. Reflect on it. What does it mean in your particular life? Remember, we're all slightly different. There are some of the things that I have said that may resonate with you. Some of the things may not resonate with you all that well. That's natural. So take those things that resonate with you. Use that. Develop it further. Make it something that is part of your way of thinking about the world, looking at other people. It becomes an aspect of right view in your life. Then it starts to work. Then it starts to have an effect on your spiritual path. So this is the most important kind or most important defilement to deal with because it is so destructive, both on the spiritual path and interpersonal relationships and everything really. But there are more defilements. And the next thing I want to look at now is more how to deal with the sensory world. Because as I mentioned before, if we want to emerge from the sensory world and we want to kind of attain a higher kind of mind, we're talking about the higher mind before, then we have to actually let go a little bit of that sensory world. So again, the things I'm going to talk about now does not mean that you reject the five sense world. It doesn't mean you give up all pleasures in that world. If you do, you're going to go crazy, so please don't do that. Still, enjoy the pleasure. These are more ways of thinking about it so that your mind gradually gets guided in the right direction. And if this is done in the right way, it just happens automatically because you start to see downsides. And it gradually, the mind just takes interest in new things. It's like if you have a joyful meditation experience, naturally you become more interested in meditation. It just happens, you know, by default because you're enjoying what you're doing. And then your mind moves a little bit more away from the five sense world. So don't take these things in the wrong way. Take them as themes of contemplation, of reflection. And if you do that, then you're using this in the appropriate manner. All right. So this is called the Potalya Sutta, with Potalya the householder. And this sutta is... the Buddha meets this man, a man called Potalya. The Buddha is sitting in the forest at the root of a tree, and this Potalya is wandering around and kind of walks up to the Buddha. And so they have a conversation. And this Potalya, he's kind of a proud person, and he thinks that he has become kind of an ascetic, that he has given up the cares of the world, the ordinary life. But then when the Buddha looks at him, he looks like he's a proud person. He's kind of wandering around with a parasol. A parasol was a sign of status in those days. So parasol, he had shoes on. That's not a sign of status in those days. And if you meet someone and you are going to be respectful according to the Buddhist customs of the time, you take down the parasol, you take off your shoes. This is a sign of respect in those days. But he didn't do that, right? He was standing there in front of the Buddha and obviously was conceited or something like that. He didn't follow the ordinary, what was the acceptable standards of that time. So the Buddha is kind of teaching him what it really means to let go of the world, right? and letting go of the world. And then he comes to these five similes, which are similes about the five-sense world and why that five-sense world is problematic and why it should be given up so as to attain a higher state of mind. This is the context here. So these are actually seven similes that the Buddha gives. And I'm going to go through these seven similes and to give you an idea of how the Buddha teaches this. So he says to Potalya, so this is the Buddha speaking, he says, householder, suppose a dog, weak with hunger, was hanging around a butcher's shop. Then a deft butcher or the apprentice would toss them a skeleton or a bone scraped clean of flesh and smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Gnawing on such a fleshless skeleton or bone, would that dog still get rid of its hunger? No, sir. Why not? Because that skeleton of scraped clean of flesh and smeared in blood, that dog would eventually get weary and frustrated. In the same way, a noble disciple reflects. With the simile of a skeleton, the Buddha said that sensual pleasures, or if you like, the five-sense world, gives little gratification and much suffering and distress, and they are all the more full of drawbacks. Having truly seen this with right understanding, they reject equanimity based on diversity and develop only the equanimity based on unity, where all kinds of grasping to the world's material delights cease without anything left over. Yeah, so this is the idea here. So the idea is to stop the grasping to the world's material delights. Yeah. So it is the holding on to that world, the craving for that world that is the problem, not that world so much in its own right. So this is the simile, right? So what does this actually mean? This hungry dog, who is this hungry dog? Well, that's us, right? We are all like hungry dogs. Sorry to break the news to you, but... It's not very polite to call people a dog, right? So I apologize for my impoliteness right there. But this is obviously this idea of the simile. Yeah. So you're like a hungry dog. Hunger is just craving. Yeah? And one of the things about the word for craving in Pali, tanha, trashna in Sanskrit, it actually means thirst. So thirst is a word also used in English. If you want to say someone is has a very strong craving or desire, it's like a thirst, right? A thirst for something, a thirst for whatever it is. It's a powerful desire. So it actually is not that far away from the idea of a hungry dog. Yeah, when hunger becomes strong, it's a very powerful drive. Yeah, you know what it's like when you become really, really hungry. And so this hungry dog hanging around the butcher shop, yeah, looking up through the windows into the butcher shop, and hoping that this butcher will have some compassion, right? But butchers in ancient India, they didn't have much compassion. And this is what they're saying. So the butcher is deft. And if you are deft, it means that you don't leave any flesh on those bones. You scrape off all the flesh because the flesh is valuable. The flesh is going to be sold to some kind of customer. It is not going to go to a dog of all things. And if you have seen the dogs in India, those of you who have been to India, a few of you have, they are really mangy and a dodgy bunch of animals. It's not like here, right, where a dog is looked after and groomed and it gets all the best. In India, the dogs are really disgusting. They are terrible. It's a completely different idea of dogs. So you can imagine, maybe it was a cute puppy that was looked after well and people would have a compassion for it, but not the dogs in India. So the scrapes off all the flesh, right? And there's a bit of blood left on that bones. So this has no value to me. Okay, in that case, I'll chuck it out to the dogs. So a little bit of compassion there. At least you do the chucking, yeah? The chucking is an act of compassion. Yeah, it's driven by kindness, that chucking. So, so you can imagine what happens then. Of course, the dog gets a bone, and dogs are always exciting when they get bones. And then there is a bit of blood there, it gets the taste, but there is no sustenance. You get the taste of the meat, the taste of the blood. You know what was there originally. It feels nice, but there's no sustenance. And because there's no sustenance, but you get the taste, craving just becomes stronger, right? Now you know the taste of it, but still it doesn't really fill you up in any way at all. The craving is more powerful. Yeah, so then you are driven on by even more craving. And when that dog is frustrated and dissatisfied staying with this butcher shop, what does it do? It runs off to the next butcher. And the next butcher, is that butcher have any more compassion? No, it's still just as, you know, just as stingy as the previous butcher. Exactly the same thing happens again. And then the dog goes on and on like this, butcher after butcher, in the same way that we go on and on, craving after craving, never finding a goal that is truly satisfying, always moving on to something else. Then that dog dies. And when the dog dies, it gets reborn. It gets reborn as a little puppy. And as a little puppy, it's probably very cute. Yeah, and then it goes with its mum. Where does it go? To the butcher shop. Oh, no. Starting from scratch, the round begins again, right? Going to the butcher shop, not finding any satisfaction. And then on and on like this, endlessly. When we die, what happens? You get reborn. If you practice well in this life, if you keep the five precepts, you get reborn as a human being, maybe even a deva, yeah? So you get reborn in a good place, but what do? You go searching again, another relationship, another more education, doing exactly the same PhD as you did in your last life. The same study, the same thing, right? Doing the same things again. And it's on, right? And after a while, you think, I've had enough of this. There is no end point to this. It's just more of the same going on endlessly. It's madness. There is no satisfaction in sight. We can see it within one life. Even within one life, we understand after one that these things that we are searching for don't give any true satisfaction or contentment. And even within one life, it is kind of unpleasant to think about that. But when you start to look at it within a multiple life perspective, it becomes literally unbearable. I don't know about you, but if I think about I've had a pretty good life, I have to admit. I've had, you know, basically, I've had good parents, I've had everything really. Still, do I want to do it again? No way I would want to do it again. Yeah, and the idea of kind of having done this thousands of times before, lifetime after lifetime, is almost unbearable, even the thought of that. So this is the Buddhist idea of what the world is like. We're always driven by craving, driven on and on and on, with no resolution in sight. The promise of craving is always that you will get some satisfaction. But actually, it is always a lie. It turns out to be true. It turns out to be untrue. That satisfaction doesn't actually exist. And so what do you do? And this is what we were talking about yesterday, about seeing an alternative. Is there a way to actually find that satisfaction? Is there a skeleton that does have meat? Does the bone with meat actually exist? And the answer is yes. There is a bone with meat. Who is the butcher who has the bone with meat? Well, that butcher, I don't know if... Can't call the Buddha a butcher, right? That's really kind of impolite and disrespectful. But the Buddha is like the person who has the bone with the meat on it, right? So you go to the Buddha, and then the Buddha says, here is the bone with meat. And what is that bone with the meat? Well, that bone with the meat is the Noble Eightfold Path. And as I was saying the other day, when you start practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, and you start to do those things that the Buddha said we should be doing, you start to be kind, you start to be generous. Thank you so much for this tea, by the way. It's actually magnificent. It has helped my throat all the way through, yeah? Mm-hmm. So you are the cause for less coughing on my part. That's wonderful. So thank you, Zach. So, and when you do those things, you realize that that happiness that comes on the spiritual path has a very different quality to it compared to the happinesses in ordinary life. The happinesses of ordinary life, I kind of always have more craving coming with them, always have more desire, even while you notice you are eating your food, right? Notice what happens when you're eating your food. You are chewing something, and you're already looking at the next thing you're going to have, right? Are you really enjoying that, or are you craving for the next one? It's hard to say, right? It's like everything is so imbued with craving in the sensory world. It's impossible to really separate the craving from the enjoyment. They kind of go together. Always driven on, always moving to something else. And then you come to the spiritual happiness, and actually it is peaceful. It has a different quality to it. It is not involved with craving in the same way. It is actually peaceful, happy, right here, right now. And for that reason, it is satisfying. It satisfies you. Thank you, Buddha. Thank you for giving something that really works. And you take that joy with you into the meditation, and you deepen it and deepen it and deepen it until one day, all the craving, all the desire is gone. And at that point, you realize you have found that satisfaction. You have found that contentment that you were looking for all the time in the world of the five senses, but was impossible to find in that world. This is what I've been looking for all the time. It's obvious when you get there, because now you feel at peace. You feel you have reached that goal, that actually deeply inside. You couldn't even maybe articulate it probably, because it's hard to articulate what you cannot just feel in a raw, visceral sense. But now you're there, you know, this is what I was looking for. And because it is what you were looking for, it is the meaning of life that you have discovered at that particular point. This is pretty powerful stuff, right? And so this is the alternative. Instead of being that hungry dog that is always moving on, you stop. You go. You don't go to a butcher anymore. You go to the Buddha instead. I have to rescue that bad simile with the Buddha as a butcher. Come out of that one. You go to the Buddha instead. And the Buddha is somewhere else. And then he gives you something that is really sustaining. And that is what this is about. This is how this path works. And the simile of the dog running around, just like we are running around, all the time. I like this translation that Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi uses when he talks about the words samsara. He talks about samsarati and sangdavati. And samsarati is the verbal form of samsara. Samsara means the eternal moving around, going from birth to death and all these kind of things. And samsarati is that activity. It's the verbal form of that. And the way he translates it, he uses the word roam. And that is such a beautiful, such an apt word in this particular context. Like I mentioned this the other day, but I mention it again, is this idea that we are aimless, right? We are purposeless. We are roaming around in these existences, going up and down, chasing mirages. They're all mirages because they don't give us the things that we actually want. And so we are roaming aimlessly around in the jungle of samsara. No idea, no perspective on the larger reality. This is why right view is so important, because it gives that perspective of the larger reality, what is really going on. And it is an aimlessness to it. And this is what we don't usually grasp, because in our lives we feel that we have an aim. We get born, we get go to school, we go to college, get a nice degree. I just remind you that it's just this fabulous universities just down the road here. In Boston, you have all these kind of world-famous universities down there, Harvard, MIT, and these kind of things down there. And we go to these universities, we think, is this purposeful, right? Ivy League University, yay, I've really made it in life. And then you kind of get married, you get a dog, because dogs are here, get a dog. You get a car, 1.5 kids, and that kind of stuff. You're the average person. And you kind of do research, and you do all of these things that seem so meaningful. And then you come to the end of your life and you look back and you wonder, was there really any point to all of this? Yes, I did all the things that were expected of me in society. I followed the conditioning that society kind of imbues you with when you get born into this world. But was it really any point? What has it got me? Now I'm going to die. I have to leave it all behind. Everything has to go. The degrees I did, all the hard work, all the money I built up, the family that I took so much care of to make sure it was a good family, it all has to go. What have I got left? And if you haven't made some good karma, if you haven't built up some good qualities within, if you haven't made your mind a more beautiful and bright place to live with, you have nothing left on your deathbed. You carry on naked, and you are confused when you die because you wonder, why did everyone tell me this is what I should be doing? And you realize that the world is deluded. The world doesn't know what they're doing. They haven't got a clue. They're just following along like sheep. be the black sheep. Anyway, let's do some meditation again. Okay. I'm not sure what happened to our Ukrainian friend. I think I may have scared him when I started talking about the Russians before. Yeah. If you do see him around, Zach, give him a pat on the back and tell him I apologize for bringing up a traumatic thing for him. You know, I can see why it can be traumatic if you are from there. So just to make sure he's okay. Yeah, yeah, great. So any comments or questions? Yes, please, Donke.
A lot of the pursuit of people in the world are, you know, pointless, like you said.
Yeah.
But there's one thing that I still have some doubt about.
Yeah.
That is the pursuit of, like, excellence.
Oh, excellence. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that is something that sort of carry over
yeah.
to your next life, the way you think, the way
yeah.
you
yeah.
do things.
Yeah.
And it's not outright like unwholesome.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the other things.
Yeah.
So how do you see the
yeah. good point. Yeah. Person? Good point. Yeah. No, that's a good point. And I think it's probably wrong to say that the pursuit of things in the world is entirely pointless. It's not entirely pointless because we are looking for happiness. We need some kind of happiness. Yeah. So from our personal experience, it is kind of immediately there is some point to it. It's just that in the big picture of things, it is kind of useless. You're right. I think what you have to do is you have to distinguish between two different things. And one is the thing that you are pursuing and how you are pursuing it. So the thing you are pursuing may be pointless, but the kind of the attitude you put into it may be a good attitude. And so when it comes to excellence, that idea of doing things well is a positive thing, right? So whether you, because that, as you say, you can take that attitude with you onto the spiritual path and use it as part of the spiritual practice. So there are many attitudes in life that may be useful. The idea of not being lazy, for example, is also useful on the spiritual path, right? They are having a degree of effort or energy and these kind of things are also useful. So I think excellence is good, but not to be too excellent. You know, because if you pursue excellence too far, it becomes like perfectionism. And that is often dangerous because perfectionism often comes with frustration and ill will and pushing other people because you are, you know, you want to kind of reach some very high, you know, results or whatever. So you have to define excellence in the right way here. If you define it wrongly, you may actually end up causing problems. So perfectionism is I don't know, when I see people, Ajahn Brahm always says 70% is good enough. And he's a perfectionist, right? So it's kind of weird that he has learned from personal experience because he was always been a perfectionist in many ways. You happy with that?
So you said the pursuit of excellence, but like more in terms of the attitude, not so much.
Yeah.
The thing that you
right.
work on.
Yeah. So you do well because doing well is always a good thing. I mean, if you're working for a company, so why do you seek for excellence? So you are trying to be excellent because you want a promotion or because you want a better salary, right? Then it's not such a good idea. But let's say that you want to do excellent because you want to create something that is useful for humanity, yeah? And maybe it isn't useful, but at least maybe it is useful, right? So if you are working in the whatever industry it is, usually we are a cog in the machinery that makes society work. And so to make that cog be as smooth and nice as possible to make society go forward, right? And to make sure, so you do your little thing in society as part of a larger machinery, and then you're actually helping other people. So you're doing, searching for excellence to be of help and to be of assistance and do something good rather than for a selfish purpose. So this is like kind of using excellence in a good way here, right? So it depends on how you use it, how you integrate it into your life, etc.
I'm just going to come back.
Yeah, please, of course, not as many times as you like, yeah.
Let's say someone who wants to pursue the monastic life, that is one block in the way that they see that, the pursuit of excellence is actually quite satisfying, or...
I would say become an excellent monk, continue the pursuit of excellence in the monastic life, yeah. who is that person who might become who's thinking of becoming a monk? Do you not know who that is? No, okay. Just a random kind of some person, okay. Sorry, all right, anyone else? We're like, yes, please, sir.
I like the background in understanding the culture and the customs of the time.
Yeah.
How could I learn more about that?
Come to these kind of talks. I think. I mean, you just read the suttas, you read the footnotes. Sometimes the footnotes will tell you what this is about. There are also books out there that have kind of studied the culture of India at that time that will give you some of these details. But then you're getting very more into anthropology and that kind of stuff. You almost get the feeling for it when you read it in this case, because the context kind of gives you the idea that this person is conceited or whatever. You kind of get that feeling when you read it. It's almost like you don't need to be told specifically. You do get, one place where it is very obvious that this is the case is in the Vinaya Pitaka, which is the monastic regulations and the monastic procedures for how to live together. And in there it says you're not allowed to give a Dhamma talk to someone wearing shoes. So if someone is keeping the shoes, actually that's a good point. Any shoes in here? No. No. So, or someone holding a parasol, not supposed to give them a Dhamma talk. Or even if you are standing and someone else is sitting, you're not supposed to give them a Dhamma talk because that's kind of a, different posture. So these are so you can tell from that very clearly what are the customs of ancient India in terms of being respectful towards other people. Now those rules are very minor rules, and those are rules that you only really need to follow under certain circumstances. So if those rules don't apply anymore to a Western context, they don't have to follow them. So for example, let's say that you give a lecture at a university. Sometimes monastics may give a lecture at a university or in a kind of a conference or something like that. Then standing at a lectern when everyone else is sitting down is fine, right? That's not an issue because there's no disrespect. The professor will stand at the front of the room and give the lecture and the students will sit down. This is just a standard way of doing things. There's no disrespect implied by that. So these are flexible rules, but they are, you're right, it's good to understand the context of ancient India to really see what's going on. So I would just recommend you to not worry too much about those minor things because they are very minor details. Just keep on enjoying the suttas, listen to people's explanations, then some of these things will come out, and gradually you will kind of start to see what is going on. That's what I would recommend, rather than trying to... because it's a lot, you can read endlessly books about ancient India, and the amount of information you get out that is truly useful is going to be very marginal compared to the effort you have to put in there. So, Please. Who's first? Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. No. Either one of you.
Well, it's clear from, from the very beginning that rebirth is central to the Buddhist teachings in the early suttas and in your personal life, like the way you see the world and the way you move around. It's
a very good point, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so for the first time, I'm actually really trying to put myself in that worldview of rebirth from eons. Because, like, my own worldview is in stark contrast. But in a way, which is why maybe reincarnation is not taught as much, because in the worldview for me, the fact that life has developed over billions of years and evolved to a place where we have consciousness and we're on this this planet for such a small period of time, that in itself is beautiful to me.
Yeah.
And so, and I mean, in some cases, I feel like if you were to ask people, well, if you do a pretty good job and you're a decent person, you might get another go at this.
Hmm.
You know, they might be reborn again. That almost is like, could be seen as an incentive. Some people would be like, oh, okay. You know, so the idea of like, of ending the cycle is some way hard to comprehend. Like, that is the goal.
Yeah. Yeah. The Buddha, this is the thing, the Buddha's teachings are challenging, yeah? They are really challenging. There is a very different way of thinking about things. And the vast majority of people would precisely, they would rejoice in the idea of rebirth because we want to exist, yeah? The idea of existence is so deep-rooted in us that the idea of coming to an end is, like, scary. Yeah? And so, yes, that's kind of how most people regard the idea of rebirth. This is why the worldview of the Buddha is... it's just so different, and you really need to try. I mean, as you try to understand it, you will, you know, you probably will kind of move a little bit in that direction. But there is this kind of getting used to the ideas, first of all. I think I mentioned this the other day, is that I read some of these books about people who have near-death experiences, for example. It's actually really, really interesting here. And did I mention this the other day? I probably did. Did I? Yeah, yeah. So can't remember what I've said where anymore sometimes. But it's very powerful because you get this feeling that there really is something more, right? I mean, some of these people who have researched these things, these are real researchers. These are some of the best universities here in the U.S. who do this kind of research. This research is becoming far more acceptable in recent years than it used to be. Yeah. And you start to read those stories, and you kind of that worldview of the Buddha starts to make more sense, because this is the kind of the detailed explanation of what is kind of writ large in the suttas. So you start to get a feeling for these things. Start with that thing first of all. Get a real feeling for this, what this actually means, rebirth. For me, it is like I take rebirth completely for granted. And when I think about life, I think about it in this kind of big context. And I think, of course, I don't want to create a miserable future life for myself. So of course, I'm going to try to live with kindness in this life, because otherwise, all I'm doing is letting myself down. Do I want to let myself down? You've got to be crazy if you let yourself down, right? So I kind of... more and more I see in that context. And it does actually have a really fundamental effect on your idea about life once you start to see the world in that way. Some people say it doesn't matter whether you believe in rebirth or not, because you should be kind and compassionate regardless. Of course, that is true. But it limits the motivation. Yeah, it makes the motivation much smaller. Yeah. But once you see the big kind of thing, it really kind of empowers that motivation in an entirely new way here. So reflect on it. And then as you reflect on it, eventually you may come to the point when you start to see the Buddha's idea of why this whole thing actually is problematic. It is not just that there is a rebirth, it's problematic that there is a rebirth. So keep on, just gently. Don't push yourself too fast, because if you push yourself too fast, if you feel resistance within you, then you don't want to make it too painful for yourself. Yeah. Please. Yeah.
Kind of related, actually.
Yeah.
So my mind in rebirth.
Yeah.
It's trying to the conceptual part of it, but anyways, I can get reborn over and over. I even understand the Mahayana Bodhisattva, that I'm going to put off enlightenment, or I'm going to keep coming back to help other beings become enlightened, like be a service for birth after birth after birth. There's a purpose. Now, what I'm struggling with is, like, when you do attain Arhatship, or the Buddha himself, you go into parinibbana, permanent Nibbana.
Yeah.
That seems like nihilism. What happens to that stream of consciousness? Like, yeah. It's extinguished, so there's nothing. Yeah. Like, so what is...
It's good, isn't
why,
it?
Why, yeah. Yeah. Why are we trying to... Why is that the goal? What is that?
It's the highest happiness.
Nothingness.
It's the highest happiness.
Is nothingness.
Yeah, the highest happiness. Yeah, exactly. That's why you want to do
but
it.
There's no existence, right?
That's why it's the highest happiness. Yeah. Well, this is the thing is that it's the reason why it is hard to understand this is because of the sense of self. The sense of self blocks our ability from seeing these things neutrally. Yeah. We are very heavily biased because of the sense of self. Once you take the sense of self out of the equation, it's bleeding obvious what's going on. There's no doubt anymore because that bias is gone. Then what you see suffering, and you see the end of suffering. The end of suffering is the highest happiness. So you see, that's all you see. Okay, right here there's suffering, five khandhas. Right there there's no five khandhas, highest happiness. Obvious what you're going to do. So sometimes what you have to do is this is where the idea of confidence in the Buddha's teachings comes in a little bit, right? You have, okay, the Buddha says that this is the highest happiness. So you can relate to the highest happiness. That's kind of easy to relate to, right? Sometimes you just have to focus on those aspects of it that actually are relatable, rather than try too hard to understand these other things. To have a degree of confidence that, okay, maybe I am deluded. Maybe I have a vested interest in something that doesn't exist. We have a vested interest in a delusion, which is kind of weird, right? And so then maybe when I overcome this illusion, maybe I will see the world in a different way. So there's always that, because we're dealing with delusion, there's always going to have to be a degree of confidence even within Buddhism. And you cannot really expect to understand these things fully, because it just can't be done without the insight.
So is nihilism because that involves self? Is that the
difference? So from anyone's perspective, when you have a sense of self, it looks like annihilationism. It looks like you've been annihilated, but actually that's completely wrong. It's just like suffering stopping. It's like you are grasping the hot cup of tea and it's painful and you let go. That's all it is. Is that annihilism? Well, it's the annihilism of suffering, but that's a big deal, right? It's good. So that's really all it is. Please, at the back there. Yeah.
So what's the downside of just considering it this one life and coming into the teachings of Buddha and living, according to the precepts and as good a life as possible?
Yeah.
And having that be the end, and you die and your atoms go into everything.
Yeah. The downside is that. When you have this idea of multiple lifetimes, the spiritual path becomes far more significant because it is about something far vaster than this life. So you start to think about existence and the spiritual path becomes incredibly important suddenly because what you are doing, you are dealing with the potential suffering, endless suffering into the future. Now you have the opportunity to make a stop to that. So this, what is at stake is far, far greater than if you kind of just look at the things coming to an end at this end of this life. So that is really the point. So, and it kind of motivates you to even become a monastic maybe when you see the big picture in that way, and you start to or at least not even if you don't become a monastic, at least live really, really well as a layperson. Yeah, do the right thing in a sense. And I think it is important, as I was mentioned yesterday, not to make this massive distinction between lay people and monastic. There isn't really so much a monastic, such a massive distinction. It's more that there is how you live as a lay person, how you live as a monastic. But at least it motivates you powerfully. And I have noticed that many of those, there are monastics as well who didn't really believe in rebirth, and they very often end up disrobing and not carrying on. And because there isn't that motivation there. Okay, yes, as a monastic, I'm giving up a lot. Yeah, I'm renouncing many things. And maybe I would like to indulge a bit more. Yeah, and if there isn't a future life anyway, if I live nicely, I can indulge more. There isn't really that incentive to really, to kind of go all the way, to try a bit harder and find that motivation there. So the Buddha, it's very clear in the suttas that the idea of rebirth is part of right view, for example, part of right outlook. The knowledge of someone who becomes fully awakened on the path is the knowledge that rebirth has ended. This is the knowledge. That is the significant thing. Rebirth has come to an end, right? So it's the very awakening experience only makes sense in light of the idea of rebirth. So it is not, it's not just core, it is kind of, you know, without rebirth, the whole thing falls apart. It doesn't make any sense anymore. What you're left with is a system of ethics and a bit of meditation to make you peaceful. But that's really all that is left of the whole Buddha's teaching. The whole idea of wisdom and insight in the larger way actually doesn't really, I mean, non-self, sure, but it's, again, has a very limited effect on you. Am I saying anything useful? Okay, good. All right. Okay, maybe we should carry on a little bit because time is going faster. So that is the first simile. And so let's now... Actually, I haven't really finished this first simile either properly. So the idea of the skeleton or the bone... sensual pleasures, yeah, again, sensual pleasure is a very limited translation. The five sense world gives little gratification and much suffering and distress, right? It's like the dog running around and it's full of drawbacks. And once you see this with the right understanding, you reject the equanimity based on diversity and develop only equanimity based on unity. So what is that all about? Sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? How does that relate to the five-sense world? And how it relates is that when you start out on the practice of the Buddhist path, we have been talking about sense restraint, yeah, all the way along. And when you have sense restraint, you have the equanimity based on diversity. When you have sense restraint, you don't allow yourself to become too angry or having too strong cravings and desires. Your mind becomes kind of even. Much more even than it used to be. Don't have this kind of yo-yo effect anymore in the mind. And that evenness you have amidst the five sense world, that is what is here called equanimity based on diversity. Based on diversity because the five senses are operating here. But once you understand the full drawback of the sensory world, you're not satisfied with that. It's not enough to have equanimity in the five-sense world. You want to give it up altogether. And that giving it up altogether is the equanimity based on unity. That is the equanimity you have in the deep states of samadhi, the fourth jhana, and these kind of things, where the sensory world completely comes to an end, is completely given up. And then once you see that, once you go beyond that five-sense world, and you understand that there is a far more satisfying happiness beyond, well, then you also give up the attachment to that five-sense world. That comes with the insight that arises very often in conjunction with the deep states of samadhi. And the grasping to the world's delight ceases without anything left over. It ceases temporarily within the jhana states, and then it ceases completely later on with the insight states. That's the idea here. That's kind of what is behind this. It kind of takes it even further. But the main point here is just to understand the similes of the Buddha and to understand a bit more about the drawbacks and the downsides of the five-sense world. This is really the main issue here. So, let's go on to the next one. Suppose a vulture or a crow or a hawk was to grab a lump of meat and fly away. Other vultures, crows and hawks would keep chasing it, pecking and clawing. What do you think, householder, if that vulture, crow or hawk doesn't quickly let go of that lump of meat, wouldn't that result in death or death-like suffering for them? Yes, sir. So then you have the same thing, the same kind of paragraph coming after, in the same way the disciple thinks in this way. The simile of the lump of meat, the Buddha said that sensual pleasures are like that. They give little gratification, etc., etc. So what does this simile about? What is the point here? And the point here is that if you are a bird and you get hold of a lump of meat, yeah, even if you're a dog, it's difficult enough to get hold of, let alone if you're a bird, very rare to get hold of meat as a bird. So you are really happy. You really, meat is kind of prized, you know, I don't know if real estate is the right word, it's prized anyway in the world of birds. And because it is so highly prized, usually you eat insects or whatever, then other birds will want exactly the same meat. And so they will fly after you, and they will claw, and they will peck, and they will try to rip that meat out of your claws, or out of your beak, or wherever it is that you're holding it. And if those other birds are bigger than you are, well, you are in trouble. Yeah, it's going to be very painful for you. And then you will meet, as it says here, either with death or with death-like suffering. It says deadly suffering, or I think, but death-like suffering is my preferred translation of that one. So this is the nature of reality, and the nature, the reason why it is like this, is because the five sense world is external to us. So just like these birds are fighting over a small piece of sensual pleasure, like a piece of meat, in the same way, in the human realm, we are constantly fighting over things in the five sense world. The five sense world is what is common to us. And if one person wants more in that five sense world, someone else is going to have less. Yeah, and very often we want the same things. We want the same partners. Yeah. This is kind of one of those dukkhas in life. Everyone wants the same partner. We're chasing after the same kind of people. And of course, so, yeah, and that is the kind of chasing the sensual objects in the five sense world. Everyone wants a promotion in their job. Everyone wants a salary raise. Everyone wants the last piece of cake, right? There is only one last piece of cake, but there's three children. Which one is going to get it, right? And so the world is such that we're always going to be in conflict with each other. Yeah, conflict is built into this world because we want the same things in this world. And that's kind of, to me, that is really off-putting. When you know that conflict is baked into the five sense world, that actually it is unavoidable in that world, it makes that whole world very, very deeply flawed. Because it is external, we want the same things. We're always going to fight over those things. Everyone wants the best house. Everyone wants the inheritance when the family dies. Have you noticed how wealthy people fight the most over the inheritance? It's kind of crazy here. You hear about some of these wealthy families fighting. There's so much money to go around. And the more there is, the more they fight over it. But of course, ordinary people fight as well because they are the favorite belongings of your parents that everyone wants, that have been passed down in generations, right? And these kind of things. So we fight in this world. And then sometimes the world kind of destroys these things. Just kind of natural disasters, or the government taxes you, and it taxes you too much, and you get upset with the government because they tax you too much. Or maybe they tax you too little. Some people say there's too little tax. Anyway, so there is a problem with this five-sense world because it is external. There's always going to be fighting over it. We're never going to find a peaceful world of the five senses. And this is kind of, to me, also the downside of the... I don't want to get into politics. This is not really about politics at all. But this is the downside also with the capitalist system. The capitalist system will always be a system of conflict because we are fighting with each other. We are trying to kind of be the most profitable. We're trying to get the best idea. Someone is going to lose. Someone is going to win. I'm not saying that there is an alternative which is better. This is not a political statement at all. I'm just saying that there is a problem with the system of the world. It is inherently going to be conflictful. So conflict in this world is inherent to this world. So what is the alternative? And the alternative, of course, is to go inwards and find the happiness, find the meaning, find these things inside instead of outside. And if you find meaning within, happiness within, there is no conflict anymore because it's not a shared experience with other people. Yeah, so suddenly we move away from the conflict in the world. And if someone says, someone is kind of jealous of you or they're envious or whatever. Yeah. Oh yeah, please, you can have my car. I have enough happiness within. Take my car, it's all right. I can deal with that. Yeah, because you're not so concerned about these things anymore. I remember a story that I heard many years ago. There was a a lady who comes to our monastery in Perth quite regularly. There's so many wonderful people who come to our monasteries. It's kind of beautiful to see that, actually. One of the great advantages of being a Buddhist monk, you meet a lot of very kind people in this world. And she came to the monastery, told this story that she had a niece or something who had this nice dress. She just bought a new dress, and it was a very beautiful dress. And then someone else came and said to her, "Oh, wow, that's a really nice dress you got there." And she said, "Okay, it's yours. I'll give it to you." And she just gave it away straight away. And that's kind of wonderful, isn't it? You're not so concerned about the things of this world. This world is not where you find the ultimate happiness anyway. Your ultimate happiness, you find it within. And the world outside, you use that to create more happiness, to be generous, to share it with other people. That's how you use that world. And then it kind of goes back within again and creates more happiness inside. So that happiness inside, because it isn't shared with people, it is a kind of, it doesn't lead to that kind of conflict. Actually, it leads to the opposite. Because if you feel good within yourself, if you have a bright mind, if you are compassionate and caring for the world, because you build up those good qualities within, you bring those with you out into the world outside. So instead of you living a life that leads to more conflict, leads to more violence, leads to more problems, you become actually a beacon of light to the world, where you bring more peace, you bring more happiness, you bring more harmony to the world. Because if you are peaceful within, you want to bring that harmony also into the world. Peace within, you don't want to have war outside, because it destroys your peace within. So you want to bring that thing into the world. So the five sense world is inherently violent. Ultimately, it is inherently violent. It is inherently full of conflict. But the spiritual world is exactly the opposite. It is inherently peaceful, inherently about harmony, inherently about working together and having a better world. So I don't know about you, but to me, this is one of these very powerful similes, because it makes the whole world of the five senses so very inherently flawed that actually you really start to lose your interest in that world. And then you start to withdraw. There is a nice perception that I often like to teach, that is one of the perceptions the Buddha says we should develop. And this perception is called the Sabba Loke Anabirati Sanya, which means the perception of non-delight in the whole world. And this is like this, this understanding the flow of the whole world. And it is out of control. You never know where it's going to go next. But you do know that in that world, there will always be some degree of violence, some degree of conflict, because that is the nature of that world. It doesn't mean that we cannot create better societies. We can. You know, if you look around the world, there are certain societies that are more dysfunctional, others are more functional. So it is possible to create better societies. But there is a limit, and there is always going to be a residue of conflict and violence in the world, regardless of how well you create your society. And then you turn away from that, and you start turning in a different direction. All right, so I'm going to stop there, because I think it's a nice place to stop. So just going to wish you all have a nice lunch. Please look after our Ukrainian friend, Zach, see if he's all right, because sometimes you kind of put your foot in it. And we'll see you back again at 2:00 this afternoon.